The word why, what a curious word. The kind of word that can make us cringe, feel defensive, or even distant. But you know, sometimes why is the key. The key that can unlock so much to our lives. Join me as we explore the why with fascinating contributors to the world. Those that entertain us, inform us, teach us about life, and if we're lucky, inspire the next in all of us. I'm your host, Dr. Rod Berger. And welcome to Headroom. Let's go.
Well, for those of you that have been following my work over the years and who very kindly purchased my book last fall when it came out, The Narrative Edge, Authentic Storytelling That Meets the Moment, I will tell you that oftentimes we talk about regrets in life. I don't have a regret, but I would tell you that if my interview guest today had been someone I had chatted with prior to writing my book, I have a hunch that this discussion would play a role in at least a chapter or two of the book. Really excited to spend time with someone that probably a lot of you either know, you might know by name, especially by some of his work, but he has his memoir out. It's In the Days of My Youth, I Was Told What It Means to Be a Man. And it is Tom Juno. He's a senior writer for ESPN, where his work has won an Emmy and the Dan Jenkins Medal for Excellence in Sports Writing. He is a two-time winner of the National Magazine Award for Feature Writing and a winner of the James Beard Award for Essay Writing. Previously, he was a staff writer at GQ and Esquire. Many of you might know the Falling Man article. The film A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood was based on his article and profile on Fred Rogers in Esquire. And he lives in Atlanta, just down the road from me here in Nashville, with his wife and daughter. Tom, so nice to spend some time with you.
It's great meeting you, Rob.
Well, thank you. I feel like I've gotten to know you, because now with the beauty of media is that I can see you on Pablo Torre or any of these interviews, and just you get it. There's a cadence, right? And it takes me back to even just in the profiles I've done and the way in which we might over the years have explored somebody's background. One of the things as we go dive into this book that I want to start with is I want to start with the power of name, because I found it interesting, Tom, that people have introduced you as Tom Juno. But when you mention Fran or Lou, your parents, Junot. And I have yet to hear anybody ask you about that. And so, not that I'm the first, but I find names to be incredibly important to people's stories. And I would love for you to explain which is the correct, and is it that you're just being deferential and kind to hosts and to writers?
No, it's so when I was growing up, my dad was the one and the only Lou Junod. And that's how we pronounce it. My father had a very specific way of talking, a very specific kind of diction. It wasn't just Lou Junod. It was Lou, pause, Junod. And it was one of those names that I didn't, you know, when I was a kid, I didn't know whether I could live up to that. And my father would even say, you know, like the question of who was and who wasn't a Junod was a really sort of big deal in my family. And when I went to college, I took two semesters of French, and the teacher called on me, and she didn't pause, she didn't hesitate. She called me Juno right off the bat, Tom Juno. And, you know, I was an English major. I was pretentious, and my girlfriend, now wife Janet, really liked it. And so, like a lot of decisions in my life, it sort of happened that way. But I really made the decision about it when I got out of college and I was a handbag salesman. And, you know, and I was following very much in the footsteps of my
dad.
Yeah,
that was your father.
He was a legendary handbag salesman. And for whatever reason, you know, I didn't really want to be Tom Junod. I felt like I was like stuck being like a junior, and I never wanted to be like that. So there was a day when the phone, you know, I got an answering machine, and I had to leave the message of what was the pronunciation of my name. So I changed it to, this is Tom Juno. And then, of course, the first person who calls me is my mom, who went full gun mall on me. My mom was in some ways sort of a cultured woman, but she was also, she could really reach back into the Flatbush tones. You know, she grew up in Brooklyn. And so she called me and she said, Tom Juno, I always knew you as Tommy Junod. So don't put the Ritz on me.
That's fantastic. Yeah. So what's fascinating about this book, right, the memoir, is that for a lot of people, they would say, wow, this is a substantial book, right? Over 400 pages.
Sure.
But diving into your story, this is not the initial draft, right? Sort of there was 200,000 words or so that were flushed down the toilet. Was it just that there was so much? I mean, help me understand that process, because I think for anybody, regardless if you're a writer or not, at what point, I know you've mentioned that you found main characters that hadn't yet even made it to the page.
Right. That's
true. In that draft. And did that, did it make you second guess at all the way in which you were sequencing and thinking about the influence of your own story?
Sure. You know, I reached a point, it was in 2020, I had taken a leave from ESPN looking to finish the book. A couple of things that were going on in my life. One of them was, I went on tour for A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. So I sort of lost track of the book a little bit. And the pandemic happened. You know, I was looking and assuming I was going to finish the book because I had just been writing a lot. That was my first strategy in writing this book about my dad, was just to write everything I could about him, never stopping, never really thinking about it. And I always thought it was going to take care of itself. And it really did not take care of itself. I just got to the point where I looked at like the sheer number of words I had that really wasn't, you know, they weren't to great effect. And they weren't what I wanted from it. So I did, it was painful. And it created a lot of doubt in me of like whether this book was finishable or not. But when I started again at September of 2020, I wrote a section that began with me as a child waking up in the morning, listening to my father's ankles crack as he himself got out of bed. And the sound of that and the memory of that and the memory of how scared I was of that sound, how love struck I was by that sound, and how full of, you know, a three-year-old, a four-year-old, a five-year-old's awe of that sound, because it was, you know, my father used to claim it was a war wound. And so hearing that and then being able to write from that point of view of a little kid hearing this sound that he identified with his dad sort of changed everything. And so that was the difference between the first go-around and the second go-around. First go-around, I was just writing everything I could think of about my dad.
You know, publishers talk about, you know, especially for new writers, it's about, do you have a voice? Have you found your voice?
That's right. That's right.
And given your work and profiles, I would think that there were some, maybe not sleepless nights, but I'd be very curious about that sort of internal conversation where you are representing someone who cast an incredible shadow. And as you're sort of getting it all out in these 200,000 words, did you find yourself almost second guessing the voice by which you were going to then write?
Well, I was really second guessing it because the voice wasn't coming. You know, you read certain memoirs and the voice is what carries you. I can name some of those memoirs. I mean, Angela's Ashes is to me the great example. I mean, here's a guy who wrote of his family's desperate poverty and tragic upbringing, and was able through this Irish lilt that he somehow imparted to his writing voice, he made it kind of a wonderful experience. There was joy, there was laughter, there were tears, and the voice did so much of that work. And I can name many memoirs for which the voice was to me the most salient part. I think more than any other form, maybe the voice has to be there. And the thing that really made me lose sleep over the first draft was the voice wasn't there. It just wasn't. There was writing, and some of the writing was good, but the music,
the humanity, right? The rhythm.
Yeah, the rhythm, the music, the sort of the magic of one person's voice trying to sort of take an experience like my childhood in just wasn't there. And when I wrote about waking up to the sound of my father's ankles crackling, it came, and there it was, and it never.
So I want to talk a little bit about the title, because I just had a hunch. I mean, that's what I love about reading a memoir from a writer, because it's, you understand the power of real estate. And you don't take it for granted on the jacket, right? But the prologue, Tom, I mean, I can't, I, maybe this is me, but there's so many books where I read a prologue and I just feel as if it was sort of this thrown in there, or it didn't anchor what I was about to read. Absolutely. I have more notes in the prologue than anything else. And I, because I allowed myself to enjoy sort of the ride or the rhythm of the stories through the book. I want to read this one section here, if you don't mind, because I'd love an intro to your father here. So speaking of your father, he didn't just want so much. He presumed so much. And the central presumption of his life was that he knew the secret of being a man. That he believed his life worthy of emulation is what made your brother Michael and you try to emulate it, and also what made you so determined to commandeer his memorial service. You said, "I wasn't trying to belittle my dad. I was only trying to get what I wanted since I became his audience at the kitchen table as a little boy. The elusive thing at the tip of my tongue that made me want to be a writer. The last word." I know this is just going to sound like shameless from a host and these sorts of things, but one of the most profound sections that I've read, that hit me like an absolute dart, because the father, son, and the last word, and knowing there's a fine line between sort of educating and teaching a young person, let alone your own child, giving them the space to breathe. But tell me a little bit about that. Like when you even hear just me reading that to you, what does that evoke in you when you think about your dad and the memorial service, which is really powerful?
Well, it evokes, you know, dinner table scenes where I felt like I had no words. You know, my father was such an overwhelming person. He was in total control of it. He had all of the power at the dinner table. He was loving and he was funny. But you had said just a second ago, talking about like having your own space to breathe. I did not have my own space to breathe growing up. And I don't think really anybody in my family did. So there was, and then when my father and my mother got into fights, which they sometimes did, my father could be really rough. I mean, to the extent where he sort of abandoned all his pose of sophistication and just sounded like a gangster. He would tell my mother to shut up. And I mean, I remember as a little kid saying to myself and to him in my head, you know, you might be able to tell me what to say, but you're never going to be able to tell me what to think. And I really think that that proposition right there is what eventually, you know, turned me into a writer. You know, the book goes really lightly on my writing career. It hardly mentions it at all, but it is also sort of explains my entire writing career. The desire to have the last word, the desire to investigate my dad's secrets, you know, all of those things shape me as a person. And then when it was time as a writer.
You kind of dabbled in writing about your dad by proxy, right? Didn't you?
Yeah. I mean, when I got to, so I got in 1993, I started at GQ. And number one, it was a man's magazine or men's magazine, as they were called at the time. And number two, I had an editor by the name of David Granger, who just encouraged me to write what you want to write, write what you feel like you have to write. And so I immediately started turning and writing stories about my dad. The first story I wrote for, you know, under, it wasn't my first story in the magazine, but it was the first story I wrote sort of under David Granger once he hired me, was a profile, not of Frank Sinatra, but of Frank Sinatra Jr. I mean, the ultimate.
Did you see his name in the marquee when you were a kid?
Yeah, When I was growing up in Long Island, we used to go and drive down Sunrise Highway, and there was this old dance hall called the Sunrise Bohemian Village, and it was big. It was this big dance hall, but it was old, and they would have this sign up every once in a while, and it would say, "Saturday night, Frank Sinatra Jr." And I was just like, that poor guy. I mean, I was a kid. Little kid, but I knew enough of Frank Sinatra, and I knew enough of being an overshadowed son myself to think that, like, oh my God, that has got to be brutal. So that was the first story I did for GQ. And then the next story that sort of was a profile of my dad by proxy was a story about Tony Curtis, who was the ultimate sort of licentious dad. You know, he had kids, Jamie Lee Curtis. I talked to her for that story, but there was nobody more important to Tony than Tony. And that was a sort of the second profile of a dad-like figure. And of course, my father loved that story. Like, he thought that, like,
yeah, because it was incredibly manly, right? I mean, this was all about, I mean, this
manly,
was,
and it was about his, you know, the what he wore, and just the idea of being like a man on the go, or just like on the hunt, is, you know, that's what Tony was. Even at age 70, he was that. And so, you know, so my dad, you know, whenever after that story, whenever I was going into the city, like New York City, my father would say, "Are you going to see Tony?" And for whatever reason, like, he thought that, like, Tony and I were, like, after that story, were like best friends. And then finally, I wrote a story for GQ about my dad, which was a story called My Father's Fashion Tips, which was an interesting story because, number one, I interviewed my dad for it, which is I'd wanted to do my whole life. Number two, I couldn't get in a lot of the stuff that he told me into the story because it would have demolished my parents' marriage. And number three, it was a story that could be read two ways: what was in the lines and what was between the lines. My father read the story that was in the lines. My mother read the story that was between the lines. And so she knew exactly what I was saying. And it was a very, very popular magazine story. People loved it. People still read it on Father's Day. But there was one person in the world who really did not like that story, and that was my mom.
It reminds me, I just recently watched the movie Fences, Denzel Washington.
Sure.
Right. August Wilson's Pulitzer Prize winning play, where this whole notion of you build a fence to either keep people out or keep people in.
Sure, of course.
Right. When you interviewed your dad for that story, how did you maintain, in essence, your voice or how did you understand that? Was it I would imagine he was excited to be a part of it because at some level, your success was reflected upon him. And there's some status with that, right? The Tony references and these sorts of things. Like, did you have many experiences where you could almost be equals or go toe-to-toe with a guy who says, if you're going to be a bear, be a grizzly bear?
Yeah. And that story was some of that because, you know, when I was growing up, my father was extremely successful at what he did. You know, my father only had an eighth grade education, but his looks, his charisma, is just his attractiveness. I mean, you know, women just went crazy over him. So he became a salesman in the handbag business where all the buyers were women. That was his public. So he was the guy in the handbag business and made a lot of money. But as he got older, as his you know, gambling addiction took its toll, as his system of personal regret took its toll, he became sort of a woulda, shoulda, coulda guy. And when I was growing up, my father lived for the moment like nobody else I'd ever seen. I mean, to this day. But all of a sudden, he was 75 years old. You know, all the clothes that he had gloried in, they were gone. The money was gone. And so that was, you know, one of the reasons I did My Father's Fashion Tips was as a gift to him, as to sort of make him a celebrity. And to restore that sense of celebrity that he had.
Was it hard, Tom, to watch him change from that public persona? Because he really is larger than life. I mean, I think probably someone who's half as skilled as you as a writer could, I mean, there was so much. It was the A1 in your description, the skin color, right? The tan.
Yeah.
We can get into all these sorts of things, but I would imagine because it was so big, right? This sort of butterfly effect of him, that I would think that was a stark difference when he's 75 and you start to see.
Yeah.
How did you handle that? Was that an internal struggle for you?
Yeah, it was tough, especially because at that time, you know, I was a magazine writer, and it was possible in 1996 when I wrote that story to be a magazine writer who was in media columns and you know, talked about on page six of the New York Post and all of that stuff. So he took, you know, he had a great deal of pride in not so much my writing, which he thought was, you know, sometimes, as he would call it, like Falling Man, for example, morbid.
Morbid.
He called that story morbid because he really, like, he loved the celebrity profiles, but he didn't love, you know, some of the darker stories that I was doing. but he knew that I was successful. And he would say to me, you know, son, I'm bursting my buttons. And it's the interesting thing with my dad. You know, my dad was a really deeply, deeply flawed guy. I mean, as we talk, we can talk about some of those flaws. But the one thing that he never shortchanged me on, or any of us on, any of his kids, any of really anybody who sort of came into the house that he liked, he didn't shortchange anybody on compliments, on being proud, and on being loving. I can't tell you how many people I've talked to since the book has come out who's basically like, hey, your father might have had some problems, but at least he told you he loves you. My father never told me he loved me. And I hear that a lot. You know, some people look at my dad was like, okay, well, he might have like had like 150 affairs on your mom, but at least he was that. At least he was, I mean, he used to go to my, I sat on the bench for my high school football team for three and a half years. And, you know, and he went to every game. He was so present.
He was a present.
He was very present. And so watching him sort of ebb away at the end was very, very difficult.
Is it something that you've been able to reconcile over the years? I mean, is that part of the, I know you've been asked about sort of like, is there, you know, some healing in writing a memoir like this? But I would just,
yeah.
When I think back to when I lost my father, you know, I find that there are these sort of memories that pop up where the way in which I organize them now, it's very different. And so it's almost like a different relationship, even though they're not here physically with us. Do you feel as if you still have a relationship with him in spirit in that regard?
I do. I mean, I still dream about my dad quite often. And you know, in the dream, he's as mercurial in the dreams as he was in life. Sometimes he's happy, sometimes he's pissed off, and sometimes he's downright scary. So, you know, all of those things he was in life, he was in these dreams. I mean, all of those things that he was in life, he's also in the book. I mean, you know, I don't try to explain my dad in this book. I try to give the reader my dad as I experienced him. And I think that's one of the strongest parts of the book. It's not like I drop in an essay about masculinity in the middle of the whole thing. Masculinity is at issue on the kitchen table. You know, when I was a little kid, the kitchen table was where it all happened. It was where my father, you know, sort of spoke, you know, most grandly about himself. And it was where I felt most powerless. So I try to give that experience to the reader. And I also try to give the experience to the reader of my dad, you know, withering away. And there's a point in the book where I take him to the VA hospital and he's down to 143 pounds. Now, my dad, when I was a kid, was built like Charles Atlas. He kind of looked like a combination. I don't know if you remember the guy. It's probably before your time on TV, named Jack LaLanne. He used to do exercises on TV.
I was thinking of like George Hamilton.
Well, George Hamilton, but I'm just talking about physical.
Yeah,
you know, my dad would stand in the mirror and worship and bid me and anybody else who was there to worship his body.
Look. Oh, I love the story where you talk about it in front of the mirror with his socks over his calves,
yeah.
Right?
And his black bikinis.
Yeah.
Look at this body. Have you ever seen a body like this? And so, you know, and so he weighed probably 195 or 200 pounds. And then, you know, at the end he was down to 143 and he said to me, look at my arms. Look at my mighty riveter's arms. Because he was a riveter before he went away to World War II. He was a riveter in the Brooklyn shipyards. He always gave that job credit for creating him. Look at these mighty riveter's arms. They look like corn cob pipes.
His use of language, I mean, it's not shocking that you became a writer, and you're so, there's such a rhythm to your writing that, I mean, you were like baked in this. One thing that spoke to me that I don't know if all the readers, you know, I think there's so many opportunities for people to sort of pick up on the humanity, but you talked about how, like, you know, and you've said this over and over again, you know, sort of, you know, you were smaller, you were, I think, 9 pounds when you were born, you had a cold, like, right out of the gate, and it was pretty serious, and thank God it was 1958, and it wasn't 1948, right?
That's right.
But then you learn through sort of conversation around adults, this concept of being an accident.
Mm-hmm, right.
And you're very curious about what that word means. And when you then relay the story of your, you know, you ask and your father tells you, and then you take that next step and saying, okay, well, then was I an accident, basically?
Right.
And
he,
it wasn't even the words, Tom, but the way in which you described how he picked you up and patted you on the back and wanted you to know that you were, you know, yeah. I'll let you finish this story, but it was just... It's kind of thing where it's like putting wine in a decanter. You just were allowing it to breathe in a way that I think a lot of people could resonate with, whether they felt that connection with a parent or they desired it.
Right. So I was 10 years younger than my brother and my sister. My brother Michael and my sister Kathy were twins. And so then I came along. And being the accident was something I heard just routinely. And so I asked my dad about it. Dad, am I an accident? And he was like, he picked me up and, you know, brought me to him. It's like, an accident? You're the furthest thing from an accident. You're our love baby. And which is a whole, you know, you go from being an accident to the love baby.
Yeah, tell me what a love baby means, Dad, right? Yeah.
Right, exactly. How is that different? You know, but of course, the thing that, you know, my purpose in life, as I understood it when I was a little kid, was to somehow save my parents' marriage, because my parents' marriage was, you know, was not great. To put it mildly, I mean, my father started having, well, he was having obviously affairs before I was even aware, but I was aware of the affair he had with my first friend's mother. There's pictures of me in the crib with a friend of mine to this day, Michael Shockett. Well, my father had in the summer of when I was 3 years old, he had a very obvious affair with Michael's mom, Valerie.
And so I want to get to that. And maybe this is a good transition point, just because so many women were a part of this book, this memoir. In ways that...
I love the women in the book. I really do.
Yeah.
I wrote about them with great, great tenderness and love. And I'm happy that I was able to do that for sure. Even Valerie Shockett.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about Muntu Lal. I don't know why, but her, like, I felt like I could picture her. I could sense the energy. And it's not even just the funeral, right? It's, which I think would be sort of, that's in neon lights. And I would love for you to share that.
Sure.
But more like what she represented, because the irony to me is, you know, I want to talk about your neighbors, Helen and Charlie Klein.
Yes.
Because in some weird way, Muntu, I think probably there was like this experience of her in the same way that Helen had waiting for her husband to come home to say, you know what kind of neighbor I think we have?
Yeah.
It just, the juxtaposition, it just jumps off the page.
Well, Muntu is the first woman in the book. She is in the prologue and she's unforgettable, right?
Forgettable.
And so, and I mean like literally unforgettable, because at my father's funeral, there were two funerals for my dad. We had two services. One was in Atlanta where my mother and father were living at the time. And I had the funeral there because I knew that my mom couldn't, by that time, my mother was in her, she was 90, and there was no way she was going to make it up to Long Island. She didn't fly. So we had one funeral in Atlanta, and then we had the other funeral in Long Island. You know, I knew that the Long Island funeral was going to be the funeral because my mom wasn't there. And, you know, my father lived a lot of his life away from my mom. He might have, you know, he was a family man in Wantagh, Long Island, but he was the man's man when he was out on the road or in New York City. So having a separate funeral for my mom might seem unusual, but it was sort of suited my dad quite well. But I planned, as you mentioned before, you know, I mean, I orchestrated this funeral. I chose the music. I hired a jazz singer to come in and sing, "I'll Be Seeing You." I gave the eulogy. I was looking for the last word, but I didn't get the last word because my father's, the words that my father used for beautiful women were never anything as like pretty or beautiful. It was always like magnificent. And this magnificent woman walked up to the lectern at the end. And she's 6 foot tall. She's a black woman with these, you know, dreads that, you know, or her braids hanging down to her waist. She's wearing capri pants, gold sandals with these, you know, huge heels that add to her already imposing stature, and a black leather jacket. And she walks up to the lectern and brings her hands down. She goes, "Can we all just agree that this was a man?" And it was one of those things. I got a chill just now just saying it. It was one of those things that just, there's so many things with my dad where you think that you're in one place. You think that you're in the shallow end of the pool. And then all of a sudden, you're over your head in the middle of the ocean. And that is my experience with my dad. And that's what happened with Muntu that afternoon in Wantagh, Long Island. And it was actually, you know, Muntu who got me started on the book, because my brother, several years, you know, God, 9 years after the funeral, my brother went out to have lunch with Muntu on Long Island. And he immediately called me afterwards and said, did you know that Dad had an 11-year affair with Muntu? And I was like, of course I did. And he was like, why didn't you tell me? And I was like, well, because I didn't know. And he goes, I'm confused. Do you know or do you not know? And that's really where the whole, I mean, in that, that's the fulcrum of, you know, of yeah, the whole book. What do you know and what don't you know about this man who formed you? I mean, I was, like you said before, I mean, I doubt that I'd be a writer if my father wasn't that guy. The way he used language, the way he walked through the world, all of those things have made me do what I do. And yet, how much do you know and how much don't you know? And that's always been sort of, for me, a test of my own manhood. What I knew about my dad became sort of my test, you know, as a young man and then now as a writer writing about manhood.
It's almost, Tom, like he had an ability to slow down time.
He did.
Right? Like you could, the way in which you talked about even your last name and the way he would say it and the pause, the pregnant pause that he would understand and capture, right, attention with. I mean, even, you know, that story about him at World War II and the serendipity of just sort of singing in the back of a truck, crooning, and how that puts him on a trajectory to me, it sort of, now you go, oh, now I understand a little bit more about the Tony Curtis piece. You start to see how these puzzle pieces come together. Talk a little bit about that, because that I think is a really formidable time in his life that,
sure,
I don't know, I guess you could say maybe it inflated some level of ego. I mean, I guess you're getting propped up, but you know better than I for sure.
Well, so when I was growing up in the, well, I was born in the late 50s. I was growing up in the mid 60s and 70s. And, you know, you grew up on Long Island at that time. I mean, every single father you knew was a World War II veteran, flat out. Some of them had stayed stateside. Most of them had gone to war. And so there was this whole group of men who were tempered by war, shaped by war. You'd hear war stories, but they were never the dark war stories. They were the funny war stories. And going up to one's father and asking to hear war stories was a part of growing up as a boy and a young man at that time. And my father, you know, was that guy. I mean, he grew up in Brooklyn. He went to war in 1943. He was seriously wounded as an infantryman in the hedgerows of Normandy. He had to go to a field hospital, almost died, you know, the whole thing. But that's with my dad. I talked about the shallow end of the pool. That's the shallow end of the pool, because the next thing that happened was that he was about to be, after he healed, he was about to be sent back to the front, and a lieutenant heard him singing and said, "Listen, you don't have to carry a gun anymore. I'm going to put you in a band." And so he traveled with a roving act that was, you know, he was the singer in a big band. And the name of the act was just the most perfect Lou Janod thing ever, because the name of the act was "For Men Only." And so he traveled all around, Europe singing I'll be seeing you singing night and day. I mean, it was an amazing story, an amazing time in his life. I mean, at the Battle of the Bulge, my father was really, really close to the front on Christmas Eve, singing Silent Night to the troops. And of course, that made him, I mean, he would have been a ladies' man under any circumstance. Such was his charisma. Such were his looks. But, you know, he had all these, you know, where other guys were eating K rations. You know, my dad was wooing French women and German women and all over the place. And so he came back and he sort of tried to make it as a singer. But for whatever reason, it was one of the times in his life where he lost his confidence. He even, you know, went and tried out. He was on the, you know, tried to be on the Arthur Godfrey show. And he went to, you know, for an audition. And later I asked him, Dad, what happened? I got the apple. And, you know, and so the apple in my home was like the dread thing. And it meant that you choked. But he would like touch his neck and say, I got the apple. We're literally like you were so nervous that you couldn't swallow. And so he never lost. When I listen to him now, I don't think he was singer enough to make it as a singer. But he never lost that charisma.
But on Britain Street, he was.
But on Britain Street, man, he was Frank Sinatra. He was Dean Martin. He looked like Dean Martin, actually. He kind of dressed like Dean Martin. But of course, all his stories were about like going into New York City and going out to the clubs that were popular at the time, like Copacabana and El Morocco. And Dean Martin noticing him and looking at him and saying, hey, like they were
like
equals.
Seeing your kind in the wild.
Seeing your kind in the wild. So my father always had that thing of celebrity. I write in the book that my father was the only celebrity I had ever met, and yet I couldn't get over the fact that the only celebrity I had ever met was a handbag salesman. And it was the thing that never quite made sense, because my father would tell me all these stories about all these women, you know, Elizabeth Taylor couldn't keep her eyes off your father. And, you know, later on I found out that he had an affair with not one, but two of the Gabor sisters. And yet, you know, really and truly, the only celebrity that he had was in the beds of other men's wives.
Hey, everybody, Rod here. In the days of my youth, I was told what it means to be a man, a memoir by our guest, Tom Juneau. The book is published by Doubleday. I hope you're enjoying this conversation that we're having, really getting underneath the stories that make up an incredible memoir, a legacy of relationships, of storytelling, and what it really means to be human. And you know what? I found this out from a friend the other day who got the book and wondered about the audiobook. Tom has such an iconic storytelling voice, and he actually did the audiobook. So for those of you that want to hear these stories in real time through Tom's voice and emotion and experience, I'd highly encourage you to check out the audiobook as well. And hey, a selfish plug, because it is my podcast, but if you'd like and you'd like to hear my voice as well, I did the audiobook version of mine, The Narrative Edge, Authentic Storytelling That Meets the Moment. You can get that book and my audiobook where all books and audiobooks are sold just like Tom's. And now back to the episode.
I think boys in general, I'm making a broad sweeping statement here.
Sure.
There's this sort of like a swinging bridge or like where you have such pride for your father. You look at him then with disdain when you see him do something that you think is not of character that you would subscribe to. How did you understand that? Because as you're telling me this story about where he, you know, he had the apple. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if those times were even that much more foundational for you because you saw the human side of your dad, this incredible personality, which made him actually more approachable in some way, like
sure.
Closer. Is that fair?
Sure. The story of him getting the apple was something that made him, you know, human to me. And if I didn't have that, I don't think that I could have written this book. You know, I've read some memoirs that are pretty one-dimensional in terms of, you know, settling scores or being sort of a final reckoning with a loved one who was also in some ways hated, right? And, you know, I read a lot of memoirs that they, you know, they're angry or they're bitter or whatever. I mean, there's anger in the book. There's plenty of it. But the humanity of my dad is something I never wanted to lose or did lose.
And so I want to transition to Fred Rogers, because I know the movie, people have seen the movie, right? And that it was the reason why the name, I mean, it was about your story with Fred, but clearly there were things in there that were sensationalized. And so sure. I think you had talked about how you just said, yeah, go ahead, but change the name, right?
Change the name, yeah.
Is that when you, I love this connection that your father would have, and I don't know exactly when he would be wearing this, but you know, he would wear that thin black tie and a cardigan, like a red cardigan. And yet then you find yourself after some bruising experiences editorially, is that fair to say?
Yes.
Being told, hey, give me 400 words, or, you know, give me X number of words on Fred Rogers. And yet you're going now to spend time with someone who has another relationship with time and attention, and the way in which my sensibility in hearing you talk about your relationship with Fred is that he could slow down time and
right.
zero in with you
right.
on the energy in the room, the energy that you were sort of giving, and he could hold that.
Yeah. Fred was one of those guys. Fred was sort of so opposite my dad. You know, they were just so far apart that I think the poles almost came together in some way, because they were both, you know, they both were in their own way. I mean, they spoke in a very stylized manner that was immediately arresting. My father did it with a certain sort of musicality of his voice, where Fred, as you just said, was able to slow down time. You know, Fred, I would say, you know, Tom, did you have a favorite sort of toy when you were growing up? And yes, Fred. What was his name, Tom? His name was Old Rabbit. Tom, I bet he was once a very young rabbit. You know, and he just had that kind of thing, and it would just, I mean, you didn't know what to do with it. You had to sort of had to give in. And that was the thing that my father and Fred, you know, had in common. But they used that charm, they used that seductiveness, because that they were both sort of seductive people.
Very much so.
And they used that seductiveness to very different ends. It's one of the ironies of my life, however, that they're both like sort of famous for like wearing red cardigan sweaters. I mean, that's the craziest thing. My father would wear a red cardigan sweater every Christmas. He would wear it with a button-down white shirt, a narrow black tie, gray slacks, and his red cardigan. And that was his Christmas thing. And it seemed, of course, my father made it look like the most manly thing that you could wear. And Fred used it to be the host of a kids' TV show.
I would think that, to your point around, you know, your father and holding the apple and the impact on your ability to write this memoir, I would, maybe I'm wrong, but it feels like if you hadn't had that relationship and experience with Fred Rogers, that this would be a very different memoir in your understanding of the complexities and the layers of what
right.
it means to be a man. Is that?
Yeah. And I mean, they really connect in some way. I mean, I think that Fred changed my writing life in general. I've talked about this before, but probably the two stories that I am, you know, that people sort of connect with me most often, the two stories that are taught in journalism schools are mostly my profile of Fred Rogers and the story that I wrote 2 years after 9/11 called The Falling Man. Those stories are connected in an odd way because, you know, Fred died in early 2003, in February of 2003. Right after that, Fred died, I began researching The Falling Man. And at the time, people were like, what are you doing? I mean, it was a really taboo story. The idea of that, of writing about people who fell or jumped from the upper floors of the World Trade Center, was just not something that people wanted to hear. And I began working on it after Fred died. And I really do believe that it was some of Fred's spirit that allowed me to write the story as I eventually wrote it, which was not sensationally and certainly not callously. I mean, there's a lot of spiritual energy in that story. And I think a lot of that came from Fred. I mean, and so many things are connected in my writing life. My dad and Fred. There was a night when a cousin of mine called me up to rip into me and to rip into my dad. I mean, he was just saying, because my father by that time was still alive, but he had withered into a very different person than he was when I was growing up. And my cousin ripped into my dad and ripped into me. And, you know, I wound up calling Fred Rogers on that Christmas morning to sort of ask him for help a little bit, because I was so upset by it. And that turned out to be the last time I ever spoke to Fred. He died 2 months later. And it was, you know, it was something. I'm so glad that I made that call on Christmas morning. And it was in some weird way connected to my dad.
As you were saying that, I was picturing it. It's as if you ever decide to do a sort of a one man sort of play of your memoir. I would contend that you need to have the kitchen table growing up, as I'm thinking about that, right? As you're talking about Fred, I know the timing obviously is different, but it made me think to when you talked about how you'd be left by yourself with a steak, a salad, and some French dressing, right? And the contemplating. And so I guess I'll use that as a springboard to ask you, where are you in the definition of manhood? Because I will tell you this, Tom, as I age, I think to myself, do I know more now or less because I've been exposed to more and different types of people that make me then think maybe more broadly or more discerning about what I think about masculinity and manhood? Where are you on that sort of spectrum of connecting yourself to what it means to be a man, given that you were living really within the shadow of a very large figure?
Well, you know, my father, like I write at the beginning of the book, I mean, he really was sort of sure that he had the answers. But a lot of those answers didn't really go very deep. My father was very, very invested in surfaces. And so when I was growing up, he would say, "My son, learn my secrets." And so, but what he meant like at the time was like, you know, rub baby oil between your hands and then put it on your face and in
your
hair.
It's like a life hack, as we would say now.
Yeah, exactly. Or, you know, or always look a man in the eye, or have a firm handshake, or the turtleneck is the most flattering thing a man can wear. All of these things. And I did what he asked me to do. I learned those secrets. But the thing with my dad is that I learned his other secrets, because there were always those things with my father as well. When he meant learn my secrets, he meant basically absorb my knowledge, take these tips, which is exactly what they like, life hacks, tips, whatever you want to call it, take them to heart. But he had other secrets, and those were mostly secrets about his, you know, had away from our family. My father had an extensive and rather shocking sexual life outside of our home. I mean, he wasn't the guy that had like the occasional fling. I mean, that was his business. I mean, even people, I've talked to people in the handbag business who were like, "How do you think he got so many buyers?" He was sort of like a gigolo. And so my father was I've heard him, seen him, read him described in connection with this book as a philanderer. I mean, he was a philanderer like Michael Jordan was a forward or a guard, I guess. It shows how little I know about basketball. But he was, you know, he was the consummate philanderer. And when I was really, really young, I was aware of that, and I was aware of how it contradicted the other things, you know, that he was so confident about the knowledge that he was trying to transmit to me. But I had to question that knowledge because I knew of the pain that it caused in my household and especially to my mom. And I was really attached to my mom growing up. It was me and mom. You know, my brother and sister left.
You're 10 years older.
Yeah. They're 10 years older than I was. And so they left our home when I was 8, say to go to college, and it was me and mom, and we were a team. And I saw close up how much pain it caused her. And that has made me, you know, that has been the thing that, you know, I've had to juggle, you know, personally, is this whole question of like, is manhood as my dad defined it sort of an excuse? Is it an alibi? Is it a get out of jail for free card? And I think that you see that a lot now. You see men who are trying to sort of, you know, come from, you know, the last, you know, 20 years and sort of coming back to where, you know, like they're not ashamed of being, you know, men anymore, as they state it. But really, how much of a man are you if every other word that comes out of your mouth is false? I think it's something that we really have to look at. Like, I think I look at manhood like as an ideal. And I think that, you know, there was a part of my dad that succeeded in presenting manhood to me as an ideal. But if it's an ideal, it's not a get out of jail for free card. It's a matter of doing some of those things that my father sort of coached me to do, looking somebody in the eye, having a firm handshake, but, you know, trying to be accountable, trying to be honest, and trying to live up to it rather than down to it.
Now, given that he was trying to teach you these tricks or these, like we were saying, life hacks, in reverse, sort of on the other side of the coin is, how did you understand femininity, females? I would think that that would, I mean, you could argue if this were an experiment that a great number of these individuals would be sort of thinking, I don't know how to even understand a relationship with a woman because my father had, it wasn't performative in the way in which I've heard you talk about that and not trying to platform it in that regard. But I would think it would be a struggle to understand the role that women and men have with one another mm-hmm. in a marriage, the courting, right? I mean, mm-hmm. It just feels like you can go down the list and think, do you feel like you were given the tips or the background to understand the value of women? Or was the contrarian nature of it too hard to deal with because you loved your mom?
Well,
and
I think
you and her, right?
Yeah. I mean, so my dad, you know, I mean, the one thing that you couldn't get away with in my house was disrespecting my mom. Like if I mouthed off to my mom, that was a deep red zone. You just didn't go there. But of course, it was just one of those other contradictions in my dad, because I couldn't mouth off to my mom, but my dad made my mom miserable. I mean, he reduced her to tears, pill taking, lots of things. But you know, the thing about my dad is that his idea of what he wanted out of me with women was one word: success. I mean, yeah. I mean, he wanted me.
Like conquest?
Conquest. Yeah. I mean, you know, there was a night when, God, I was 20 years old. I was already dating my now wife, Janet, you know, very, very seriously. He called me to come into town. Town meaning New York City, and told me to dress up. We were going to go out to see Woody Allen at Michael's Pub in New York City. And so I meet him in New York City, and we go out to the bar at the Plaza Hotel, and these two stunning women walk in and walk directly towards us. And I was like, Dad, who are these women? And he was like, they're our dates. And so he, you know, he wanted to set me up, you know, with women, you know, all the time. When I was turning 18, he went to my best friend, Rick, and said, I'm thinking of getting a hooker for Tommy for his 18th birthday.
As so many fathers think, right?
You know, so that's who he was. Figure out, you know, I wanted to relate to women really through my mom, you know, and the thing about the relationship I had with my mom is that I was, you know, with her and, you know, she taught me, you know, a lot of stuff. I mean, so there was a moment when I did the story, My Father's Fashion Tips, in 1996, and the story comes out, B. Altman, the store on Fifth Avenue, does a display striking picture of my dad that accompanied the story. It was shot by a photographer named Marion Ettlinger. It's a picture of my dad drinking a martini in a tuxedo, and it's a striking photo. And so that's in the window of a store on Fifth Avenue. It's a very successful story, but there's one person I don't hear from, and that's my mom. And finally, after like a week and a half, I call her and I was like, "Mom, have you read the story?" "Yeah, I read the story. What did you think?" So there's a long pause, and she gave me this answer, and it was, "Don't forget who raised you, kid." And I didn't forget who raised me. I mean, my dad, it was like an ongoing show. It was like going, it was like when you're with my dad, it was like going to the carnival. But, you know, when you're with my mom, it was like, it was real life. And my mom, she taught me a lot. The great thing about this book, the part that I am proud of, other than the fact that I don't get didactic and I sort of give my dad to the reader. But the thing that I'm really proud of is that, you know, the people who ultimately tell me what it means to be a man are the women in the book. I mean, they are strong, strong characters, and I present them as such. There's my mom. There's my unbelievable Aunt Ellie. There's my Aunt Seal, confirms a lot of the stuff that I'm thinking about, the relationship that my mom had with my father. There's my wife, Janet. There's my daughter, Nia. There's my sister, Kathy. I mean, there's a lot of really important people in the book who are powerful female characters. I even go out and meet and talk to and interview some of my dad's lovers. I go out and find and talk with Muntu Law, and I go out and find and talk to, you know, Valerie Schockett, who had an affair with my dad, you know, when I was 3 years old. And they talk. They tell me the truth. There's a point in when you grow up as I did, where secrets were the coin of the realm. You know, you go out and you talk to people, and they tell you the truth, and they answer questions that you have had your whole life, such as Valerie Schockett, such as Muntu Law. I mean, the gratitude that you feel for them, towards them, is almost physical. I mean, it's unbelievable that somebody, oh my God, Valerie Schockett is finally telling me the truth of something that I've known about and at the same time not known about since I was a really little boy. So, you know, the women in the book are strong characters, and I could go on and on about them.
No, it's beautifully said, because it's like looking at art and trying to understand the negative space and its relationship to the art that you're seeing or presented to you. I think about that. We haven't talked about the briefcase. I think about what preceded that as a young person to go and sort of break into, technically, I guess,
right,
your father's briefcase to reveal kind of what you were thinking, correct?
Right. Right. I mean, and that is the thing about my dad. It's the old, you know, you're in the shallow end of the pool and you're like, I wonder what it's like in the deep end. And then you go in the deep end and it turns out to be the ocean. You know, it's like, it's always, you know, with my dad, I had a lot of suspicions about my dad when I was a kid. And all of those suspicions happened to be true. That was the thing with him. If you thought it was, you know, there were no wild goose chases. There were no blind alleys.
Which is so fascinating, Tom, because you would think that a character in a movie that's not your dad, that there's some value placed in the mystery of it all, right? And that you can't figure everything out because I'm too good. And yet you kind of read the book thinking, well, one, he's a likable character, yes, even though he's, you know, I guess, inflicting all of this emotional pain and levels of abandonment across family members.
Right.
But that it's like he wants people to know to some degree.
So that's a really interesting question, because I am asked a lot, what would your dad think of this book? And so there's an obvious question. I mean, I'm sorry, there's an obvious answer to that, which is he would freaking hate it. That's one answer. But as you say, I mean, there was a side of my dad that was, if this is even possible, it sounds like an oxymoron, but he was exhibitionistic about his secrets. You know, you're not supposed to be an exhibitionist about your secrets. But my father was an exhibitionist about his secrets. So the cover of my book is my father dancing with a woman in the basement of our house, who is clearly the woman, the look on her face, her body language, she's clearly in a state of erotic thraldom to my dad. I have no idea what she is, but I do know that that took place in front of everybody. These kinds of encounters would be during parties in our basement. And so there were things, you know, I guess that I was able to see it. And I think that I was able to see it because I was so connected to my mom. I think I was supposed to see it, actually.
It's like an emotional radar that you have.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that my dad kind of wanted me to see it because he wanted me to be like that. And my mom kind of wanted me to see it because she didn't want me to be like that.
And so you could feel her like pain in some way, right?
Sure. Yeah.
It had to be a lonely existence. Tom, I'll get you out of here on this. I had mentioned earlier, I had referenced the old neighbors on Britton Street, Helen and Charlie Klein. And this great story of when moving in, I believe you guys had just moved in, maybe it was, and your dad goes over and knocks on the door it's quite an encounter for Helen in the 50s.
Yes. This right? is before I was born.
Before you were born.
Yeah.
And it's not even the story of just that she thought that he was homosexual or anything like that, because he was being, I guess, flamboyant in the way he was dressed. But really the question, Tom, that I kind of want to bookend this with is, do you find now in retrospect that it is people's experiences of your father that really helped to define the man that you call dad, as opposed to the things that you witnessed directly from him?
Yes. I mean, yes and no, because a lot of people were fooled by my dad. You know, to this day, to this moment, I've gotten a lot of notes from people I grew up with who were just like, wow, man, I didn't know it was like that. Your dad was always so kind to me. Your dad was always so interested in me, because he would tell them what it meant to be a man. You know, hey, chick, you know, why don't you have a girlfriend? Mr. Janatum's shy. Chick, you know, all you got to do is just go up there and say this, you know, and that's the way that he would be. And they remember that. But the question of where the public life exists, if you have this sort of incredibly prodigious and complicated secret life, what's the most important thing? Like, is the most important thing the tips that my dad gave me about turtlenecks, or are they about the evidence I found in his briefcase that he had a pretty sordid secret life? What's the most important thing? And that's, I think, is been, there we go.
Yeah, see, you're done.
I told you that was going to happen. And we're at the end of the conversation. Yeah. Thanks, Jacques. But I think we'll be able to get through this. But there's that question of like, what's the most important thing? And how do you square that? And I think that there was a moment in this book, and it was when I was really trying to find the voice for the book, where I basically had to say to myself, I loved him then, I love him now. I have to be true to that. If I'm going to be true to myself, I have to be, as difficult as that is, as unworthy as my father is sometimes of that kind of loyalty, I have to be true to that. And that's the thing that I think ultimately allowed me to write the book. You know, I love everybody in it. You know, I write with that. And that's, it turned out to be, you know, my secret weapon in writing the book, sort of, because it allowed me to write really truthfully about everybody and not think that I was just scorching them, you know, that I wasn't, that, or even worse than scorching is not even the right word, that I wasn't betraying them in some way. I reveal my dad's secrets pretty unflinchingly, I would say, but I don't betray how I felt about him. I don't betray that part of myself, and I don't betray that part of me. I mean, I'm sorry, that part of him. And I think that that's what allowed me to get through it.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I never, in reading it, it never felt slanted in any way at all. It, like, you gave me an opportunity as a reader to sort of bear witness to these incredible stories and then really integrate them into my own experiences and think, how might I respond? Well, I have to tell you, Tom, one of my favorite, I don't know what, you know, do I say of the decade or whatever, but I just, this is one that I'll keep close because the power of the writing and just to know the way in which your dad would utilize language and how it still lives within you and the work that you do is a real gift as we now become such a synthetic world. So I just applaud your writing and your really bravery in writing about your family in a way that is, it's completely, I mean, you're exposing it all. And it shows a humanity, Tom, and I think we need more of that. Well, it's In the Days of My Youth, I Was Told What It Means to Be a Man, a memoir by Tom Junot, put out by publisher Doubleday. Tom, what a fantastic experience. Thank you for enlightening me and making me think about my own relationship to my father. That's, to me, the greatest compliment I can give to an author, and we really thank you.
Well, thanks so much for having me, for these great questions, for the time to really get into it. I really appreciate that.
Thanks for taking the plunge into Headroom, where we uncover the why behind the what and who impacting our lives. I'm your host, Dr. Rod Berger, and this is Headroom.